This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, PCBs. What risks do they pose for human health? Scientists review the cancer data and the damage PCBs do to babies' brains while still in the womb. Gray whales are making a comeback from near extinction. Sometimes there is good news. We meet the bear woman of Idaho, who raises orphaned cubs and puts them back into the wild at hibernation time. Swats and lumps come with a job. And on the Earth calendar, blue-footed boobies are nesting and mating in the Galapagos Islands. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs, were considered benign when the chemicals were first used in the manufacture of electrical equipment more than 50 years ago. By mistake, huge doses were mixed with rice oil in Japan in the 60s, which had a serious effect on people who ingested them. Efforts have been underway ever since to determine their toxicity. The use of PCBs was banned in the United States about 20 years ago, but since they do not break down in the environment, 70% of the PCBs ever manufactured are still out there. Debate about their impact goes on and on. The General Electric Corporation was responsible for dumping PCBs in the Housatonic and Hudson Rivers. It's facing huge potential liability for the cost of cleanup and health-related claims by GE workers. A recently concluded GE-sponsored study is being heavily promoted by the company to show cancer risk from PCBs has been overstated. I asked Lynn Goldman, who for the past 5.5 years was U.S. EPA's Assistant Administrator for Prevention, Pesticides, and Toxic Substances, to assess the PCB risk.
Most of the risks that we are concerned about are risks with low-level chronic exposures, such as the exposures that may occur environmentally and also in the workplace. And there are really two sets of risks that we are concerned about. One is cancer risks, and we are aware of the hazards of PCBs for cancer largely because of animal testing. The second issue has to do with risks to children and particularly development of children's brains. That we know about because of studies of people who consume high levels of PCBs, whether very high levels because of accidents that have occurred in different places in the world, or moderately high levels because of having a lot of PCB-contaminated fish in their diet.
Deborah Lee Davis, former member of the Federal National Chemical Safety and Hazard Investigation Board, and now a senior scientist at the World Resources Institute, describes what laboratory tests indicate about PCBs and cancer cells.
There have been a number of studies finding a link with PCB-similar compounds and breast cancer. But these studies are more difficult to interpret because there are negative studies and positive studies. But the bottom line is, if you take PCBs in a laboratory and expose it to breast cancer cells, you can dramatically increase their growth.
The recent GE-funded cancer study was conducted by Dr. Renata Kimbrough. She says her research had oversight from an independent review committee that was not picked by GE. She analyzed the death certificates of 7,075 GE workers who were on the payroll sometime between 1946 and 1977, and worked in plants that used PCBs.
Basically, we found that death rate for all causes and all cancers was lower than expected, and the death rate for all other chronic diseases, such as heart attacks and strokes, was also lower. And none of the specific cancers were statistically significantly elevated in any of the different groups.
Kimbrough says her study shows that animal data is not applicable to humans.
You see, I was the person that did the initial animal study and published that in 1975, where we found increased numbers of liver tumors. But And also, my study is not the only study. There are a number of other studies, and if you look at all of them, in the aggregate, I'm talking now about the workout study again, if you look at all of them in the aggregate, nothing really falls out. And so I would conclude from all of that that PCBs, even though they cause tumors in rats, they may not be potent human carcinogens.
Lynn Goldman, who has reviewed the Kimbrough study, says it does not settle the cancer issue and that press reports have blown it way out of proportion.
This study will contribute to that body of evidence, but it certainly does not trump all of the other evidence that is already in place. And some of the reports that have suggested, because it appears to be, quote, negative, that therefore we should not be concerned about cancer risks from PCBs in humans, that would be a foolish way to utilize a study of this sort. There are plenty of other data that indicate the contrary.
Linda Birnbaum, Director of Experimental Toxicology for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency at Research Triangle Park in North Carolina, says we need to focus on other effects of PCBs.
Well, I think cancer is probably the least of our problems when we deal with PCBs. Certainly from our animal studies, we know that PCBs are associated with a plethora of responses ranging from immune suppression, from liver toxicity to dermal toxicity to effects on our hormones and possibly most importantly to effects on our developing nervous system and reproductive and developmental effects. So that I think that that's probably where we have greater concern.
The impact of PCB exposure to the developing human fetus has been observed in children of the Great Lakes region. Dr. Peter Orris, Director of Research at the Great Lakes Center for Occupational and Environmental Safety at the University of Illinois School of Public Health, describes findings that were made from 313 births by mothers who had eaten Great Lakes PCB-contaminated fish during pregnancy.
There was a difference in head circumference and prematurity and a couple of other items, but you know, you don't really know what to take of that because there are many causes of these things. They then followed them up to 4 years of age, and they still found that the weight differentials were still there, which is unusual for prematurity. And now they additionally found poorer memory and attention problems in the four-year-olds that were exposed. This cohort now has been followed through 11 years of age, and it was published a couple of years ago now in the New England Journal of Medicine. At 11 years of age, startlingly enough, they have found that those highest exposed are more likely to be 2 years behind in school. There seems to be an average IQ drop of around 6 points.
It appears the debate about PCBs will continue. The one fact that all scientists agree on is our bodies accumulate PCBs in fatty tissue throughout our lifetime. Few animals have been at the center of as many news stories over the last 12 months as the California gray whale. Last year, the Mackay Indians in Washington State decided they wanted to resume a tradition of hunting gray whales in the Pacific. Meanwhile, in Baja California, the Japanese industrial giant Mitsubishi continues to create controversy over its plan to build a state-of-the-art salt evaporation complex near lagoons where gray whales breed and give birth. 50 gray whales beached themselves along Baja California over the winter, making some scientists wonder whether human forces are the cause. Despite these recent events, the scientists say the future of the animal is bright. It's a remarkable success story of a species that has returned from the brink of extinction. Stephen Westcott reports.
Native Americans have hunted gray whales on a subsistence basis for centuries, but it wasn't until European settlers found them wintering along Baja California that their populations began to decline.
Around the 1850s is when the whalers discovered the lagoons. And, you know, that gave them the opportunity to take their vessels in and anchor up, and, you know, they could just kill them as fast as they wanted to. It also gave them access to cows with calves, and they found those to be the easiest animals to chase down and to kill. So not only were they taking the cows, but they were killing off all the new young calves. So it just drove the population down very rapidly.
That's Wayne Perryman, fisheries biologist with the National Marine Fisheries Service's Southwest Fisheries Science Center near La Jolla, California. Perryman says in the mid-19th century, gray whales and other marine mammals were in high demand for their oil, fur, and meat.
And remember, back in the 1850s is when the gold rush was taking place, so you had all of those mines, you had all of those lanterns, and not only whale oil, but also oil from seals was very, very valuable at that time.
Meat from the gray whale was used for food. Bone was used for bicycle saddles and boot laces, and whips and umbrellas were made from their baleen. It's estimated that at the peak of commercial whaling around 1855, more than 470 gray whales were being killed annually. The whales that at one time may have numbered around 50,000 or more were decimated, so much so that scientists find it difficult to determine just how many were slaughtered.
Well, we weren't around to count them back then, so the only way we can estimate how low the population really got is by trying to track down whaling records to see how many animals were taken. We know about how fast they can reproduce, so we can kind of work backwards from now and try to calculate how many were there. It's pretty much, a seat-of-the-pants guess, but they were, I would say, down to maybe a few thousand. They were certainly economically extinct, which is probably what saved them.
With the gray whale so close to extinction, efforts began around the middle part of this century to protect the medium-sized whale.
Well, the abundance has steadily gone up. There are some ups and downs in it, but it's very convincing upward trend since the start in the 60s. And now the abundance is around 26 to 27,000.
David Rue is a wildlife biologist at the National Marine Mammal Laboratory in Seattle, Washington, which is also part of the National Marine Fisheries Service. He and other scientists, like Wayne Perryman, are able to monitor gray whales as they make the long spring migration to the Bering Strait in the North Pacific. Rue says the listing of the gray whale as an endangered species in 1972 played an important role in the animal's recovery.
The gray whales were one of the first species to come off the endangered species list. So we found that they were on the list probably appropriately because there was concern, but as we looked at how many there are and saw how well they were doing and continuing to do, we could no longer justify calling them endangered. There are others that are truly endangered out there, and so we dropped them from the list. And just yesterday, we finished a five-year review of how the whales have done in the past 5 years since being removed from the list. And it was concurred by a group of scientists and conservation groups, scientists both from Mexico and the U.S. They are not endangered. They are not threatened. They should stay off the list.
While this population of gray whales is rebounding, others have not been so lucky. A population that lived in the North Atlantic became extinct as a result of hunting in the 17th century. Another population residing off the coasts of Russia and China today has been decimated, and scientists fear only 70 animals may be left in the wild. Researchers are so used to dealing with dwindling whale populations that the resurgence of the California gray now presents scientists with an interesting question. Will the population cap off or continue to grow? NIMFS biologist Wayne Perryman.
We really don't know much at all about whales at population levels that are approaching carrying capacity. Most of our data comes from whaling, and so the only animals we really get to study are from populations that are depressed. So this is pretty exciting stuff to watch this population. We have a lot of theories of what should happen, but to see what really happens as a population of large whales approaches the limit of the environment is going to be pretty exciting.
Perryman adds that there is some evidence that populations of small crustaceans that gray whales feed on in the North Pacific are declining. Some believe it could be due to overgrazing by the rebounding whales. If this is the case, it is possible the number of gray whales may soon level off. Wayne Perryman says over the next 5 years, scientists should have a better idea as to whether this environmental success story continues to grow or reaches its carrying capacity. For The Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
The Environment Show is a national production. It's made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Give us your thoughts about the environment and what you hear. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Email is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org.
I'm Linda Anderson, and this is Ear to the Ground with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, bare essentials. Bare seems so invincible that it never occurred to Sally Maughan that there could be such a thing as an orphaned bear. That is, until the Idaho Fish and Game Department brought Maughan, a wildlife rehabilitator, a traumatized black bear cub. That bear, she says, turned her life around and led her to founding Idaho Black Bear Rehab Incorporated out of her home in Garden City. For the past 10 years, Maughan, dubbed by local wildlife officials as the Bear Lady, has taken in 42 black bear cubs. Cubs who became orphaned when their mothers were either hunted or poached, killed by cars, fires, or died for other unknown reasons. Maughan says the cubs arrive as early as March and as late as the end of December and range in age from 6 weeks to 11 months. Left on their own, they would surely die, but luckily they have Maughan as their den mother.
When you're talking about young cubs that I've raised from, 5 weeks old or even for 3 or 4 months old, they pretty well identify me as mom and they treat me like another bear. And that means I take my lumps, I get the swats, I get the bites, just like they do when they're playing on top of their mom or, looking to get into trouble, as kids will do. And the older bears that come in, we get some in the fall from having been orphaned during summer, perhaps. And when they come in, they, of course, don't recognize me as mom, but it doesn't take them very long to react to the way the other bears are treating me, and they pretty much then begin just treating me like another bear as well.
Though the bears require a lot of attention and pull at the heartstrings of Maughan, the business of rehabilitation is about getting them back into the wild. After spending months in a chain-linked enclosure with 160-gallon swim tub, logs, and doghouses, it's time to move on. Sometime between mid-November and late December, when the bears weigh between 60 and 100 pounds, Maughan begins to prepare them for hibernation.
When the weather starts getting cold, and about the first part of November, I will start tapering off the food and cutting back a little each day. And then usually by the middle of November, we have a pretty good idea what we're facing weather-wise in December and when we might go. So at that point, I will pick a date about 3 weeks out and just stop feeding altogether. And it sounds horrible, and as a wildlife rehabilitator, the first time I did that, it was horrible because you're used to piling on the food when you're getting ready to release, so they have plenty of fat. But these guys need that. The lack of food and the cold weather is what kicks them into hibernation.
When they're ready, the bears are tranquilized and transported to den sites that include small caves or dugouts under trees. And there they will remain, Maughan hopes, until spring, when they are left to forage on their own. Maughan says in all the years she's been doing this, only 4 bears have died before release, and only 1 became a nuisance bear and was sent away to a university for a research project. The success of her work has been receiving a lot of attention and recently attracted aid from the World Society for the Protection of Animals based in London. A bear specialist there says, on a global basis, there's no one doing what she's doing as well as she's doing it. However, since black bears are not an endangered species, some argue that saving a few cubs is not worth it. Some, Mon says, feel the cubs are just a nuisance, to which she responds,
"They are not endangered, and there would be two arguments to that. One is it's the right thing to do, and in many cases the cub is orphaned because of human interference or human problems that created the situation that caused it. And it's a chance to correct that and give it a second chance. And then what happens at that point is the cub, when it's released, has to take its chances just like the other bears in the wild and face the same dangers. So all you've really done is give it a second chance to offset and correct some of what probably we caused in the first place. The second, and probably even more important, is the fact that when you have a good population of black bears, which we do here in North America, one bear doesn't make a difference. It isn't going to impact the population whether you do or don't put it back. But when you have a threatened or endangered population, as they do, for example, in South America and some other areas, then what we've learned the past 10 years can be taken and adapted to that, because then every single cub becomes important, and you need to be putting those cubs back or you're going to lose your population.
With Ear to the Ground, I'm Linda Anderson.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. As you listen to the show, blue-footed boobies are nesting and mating in the Galapagos Islands and on nearby coastal Ecuador in South America. Dr. Gregory Miller is Vice President for the Andean Southern Division of the Nature Conservancy's International Program. He says the process begins with males choosing nesting sites.
Blue-footed boobies will pick flat areas just off generally cliffs or beach areas. They don't nest on sand. It's generally on a hard surface, either a lava flow or another flat cliff-like area, just off from the edge of the water.
After a male has chosen a spot, he marks off the nest by placing stones in a circle. He then deposits guano around the stones, which tells other males that this is his territory. Dr. Miller says that's when the male attempts to attract a mate through an elaborate courtship display.
He will then build this little ring of stones, defecate, and then he will do what's called a sort of sky-pointing behavior, when females will then fly over groups of males. They're a colonial nester, and then the male will put his bill in the air. The males whistle. The females have kind of a duck-like honk or a duck-like kind of sound. The male puts his nose in the air, which is called a sky point, extends his wings fully, and raises his bill up, puts his tail out, pointed almost at a 90-degree angle from his bottom, and then does a very prominent whistle. And this is demonstrating some kind of characteristics of suitability as a mate.
Once mating is complete, females lay eggs that both mom and dad help to incubate. The eggs hatch about 40 days later.
It takes generally 7 to 9 months for eggs to be produced, to be hatched, and then the young to fledge or to leave the nest. So let's say a maximum cycle could be up to even 7 to 9 months between sort of what we call breeding events, from when they breed, produce eggs, and then have a clutch, which is 2 to 3 eggs.
Blue-footed boobies are a member of the pelican family. At maturity, they're about the size of a goose and weigh between 3 and 4 pounds. They can live to be more than 17 years old. While their most prominent feature is their beautiful blue-webbed feet, they also are fierce hunters. They frequently hit the water at speeds that might crush the skulls of other birds. Air sacs in the blue-footed booby skull cushion the impact. The name booby is Spanish slang for bobo, meaning clown or stupid fellow. The birds were given this name because of their comical behavior, their clumsy appearance on land, and because they lack the fear instinct of other birds. So next time you're at the circus and see a clown with blue feet, ask him if he has relatives on the Galapagos Islands. If he starts placing stones in a circle, get out of the way. You know he isn't clowning around. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, we celebrate the arrival of spring with music director Jeff Reynolds, who introduces us to two classical compositions which commemorate the change of season. We talk green with Jane Goodall, world-renowned scientist whose research has given us an appreciation of the intelligence of our closest animal relative, the chimpanzee. Now, she is organizing environmental education on a global scale. And listeners comment on solar power, bias in the funding of research, and the effect of poverty on the environment. Stay with us. Spring is here, which means in many parts of the country, animals of all kinds are becoming active, plants are blooming, and there is a fresh smell in the air. For centuries, the newness of spring and the rebirth of the natural world has inspired musicians. In celebration of the end of winter, we turn our attention to the music of two classical composers with the help of Jeff Reynolds, director of choral activities at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, and music director of the International Cathedral Music Festival.
In talking about classical music and spring, classical music is replete with instances where composers were encouraged and inspired by spring coming off of a cold winter. And one cannot talk about spring and classical music without starting with Antonio Vivaldi. Vivaldi, the Italian red-headed priest, as he was known, not only because of the color of his hair, but also because of his temperament, was born in Venice in 1678 and died in Vienna, 1741, thus bringing to an end the Italian Baroque era. He was son of a baker, a profession he adopted before becoming a professional violinist, and worked for a long time at an orphanage for girls, where he was the music director and composed a great deal of music for them. We know him today for his 500-plus concertos, many of which have descriptive titles, just like his Le Quattro Stagioni, or The Four Seasons. The first four of these 12 concertos, Opus 8, are published under the title The Contest of Harmony and Invention. Each of the movements is prefaced by a sonnet or a poem, which we presume the composer composed himself. And phrases were inserted into the solo line of the solo violin at the appropriate point to explain the music more easily, as Vivaldi put it. His first, La Primavera, or Spring, is for solo violin and strings. In the first movement, which he marks allegro and is in E major, we find the coming of spring by a gay and joyous melody that gets rid of winter altogether and joyously marks the beginning of the warmth weather. We find in it also the singing of birds brought about by trills in the violin, a storm which we in music know as the stile agitato, or a fast, repeated series of notes to affect thunder. From Vivaldi, we go to the classical composer Franz Joseph Haydn, who lived 1732 to 1809. Haydn, along with his Austrian compatriots, Mozart and Beethoven, was a quiet gentleman, a servant to the Esterházy family. For most of his life, he lived in Eisenstadt, a small town just outside of Vienna. Later in his life, as the prince began to release him and let him travel a bit, he went to England on two very well-known trips and was very impressed with Handelian oratorios. He wrote the wildly popular The Creation, or known in his tongue, Die Schöpfung. Later, the oratorio The Seasons, or Die Jahreszeiten, in 1798, which was first performed in his native Vienna in 1801. This work, The Seasons, depicted simple farm people and their love of work, play, hunting, and, of course, the Austrian drinking. Like The Creation, it is filled with vivid tone painting in the orchestra and the chorus. The introduction to this depicts the passage from winter to spring. Simon, the character, one of the characters in this oratorio, is a farmer who begins the oratorio with the announcement that spring has finally arrived. The chorus then joins welcomely with "Come, lovely spring." You've been listening to The Environment Show. This is Jeff Reynolds at the University of Alabama in Birmingham, and we've been talking about classical music and spring themes.
We're Talking Green, and I'm Peter Burley. My guest today is a scientist who is known to just about everybody in the world who's interested in animals and wildlife. She's written extensively, lectured around the globe, spent a lot of time in the jungle in Africa, and won almost every environmental prize there is. The world's foremost researcher on chimpanzees, her books include Wild Chimpanzees and In the Shadow of Man. She is Dr. Jane Goodall. Dr. Goodall, welcome to our program. You've undertaken a project which has the name Roots and Shoots, and my understanding is you're spending some time now promoting and talking about that. What is it all about?
Well, what really the Roots and Shoots program sprang from a sort of life-changing event for me, which was a conference in 1986. In which all the chimp experts, field experts, came together under one roof. And during that conference, there was a session on conservation. And it was utterly shocking to see how all over Africa, wherever people were studying chimps, the same grim story, chimps caught in snares, deforestation, fragmentation of populations, hunting for the live animal trade, and perhaps worst of all today, the so-called bushmeat trade, hunting animals to feed people in cities who prefer wild flesh to domestic animals. And that led me to realize that I couldn't sit in my beautiful forest anymore and go on learning about these amazing chimps. I must leave that to others, and I must move out and see what I could do to try and conserve the chimps and their forests. And corny though it may sound, the future of the world really is in the hands of the young people today. So I began working extensively with youth in Tanzania, realized that the problems of Africa are so closely linked to economic interests of the developed world, which took me to work with youth in the developed world. Roots and Shoots is a program for young people from kindergarten to university to try and make their world a better place for animals, for the environment, and for their human community. And what they do depends on where they're living and what the problems are. It's a hands-on program.
And I take it it is ongoing both in Africa and throughout the United States.
Absolutely. There's about 1,500 groups in North America. There, I'm not sure how many there are in Tanzania, but altogether throughout 30 to 40 countries now, there are about 2,000 or slightly more groups of Roots and Shoots of different ages. And, you know, it's incredibly inspiring to read from the reports what these different groups of young people are doing, how enthusiastic they are, how utterly convinced they are that they are changing the world. And they are. That's the point. If we can't give them hope, if we can't empower them, as well as teaching them the problems, then I think there isn't much hope for the future.
Are these programs focused in classrooms then, or are they set in other contexts?
They're all over the place. They started in secondary school in Tanzania, and then they came over to North America. Then they started creeping downwards into kindergarten. Even we have preschool groups. And we've actually got an amazing program in a woman's prison in Danbury, which I visited yesterday. So the inmates are beginning to feel that they are, after all, some use to society. It's quite extraordinary what's happening. And by the way, the name is symbolic. Roots creep under the ground, make a firm foundation. Shoots seem very small and weak, but to reach the light, they can break through brick walls. And we see the brick walls as all the problems that we've inflicted on this poor old planet, you know, overpopulation, deforestation, spread of the desert, hole in the ozone layer, predicted global climate change, or maybe we're seeing it. And on top of all that, we've got human greed and cruelty, crime and war. But the message is hope that hundreds and thousands of young people, Roots and Shoots, around the world can break through. And the main message, every individual matters, including non-human, and each one of us has a role to play and makes a difference.
And this obviously inspires, hopefully, activism on the part of the people that are involved. How do you see the Roots and Shoots graduate fulfilling this role of making a difference in terms of environmental sustainability?
Well, I think they develop a kind of philosophy which many environmental groups around the world also develop, you know, that they can make a difference. But hopefully, as this Roots and Shoots program takes off, and it really is taking off now, I mean, it's growing faster than I can keep up with, that the graduates will have the, you know, they will be able to support each other when they get out of school, out of university, in the real world where they have to make a living, where they may have to choose to be forced to work for an organization which they consider is damaging the environment. But if they don't compromise their own values, I always tell them, you can work inside. You can very gently try and change attitudes in this company that you disapprove of.
And for the listener to the Environment Show who would like to get involved with this or bring it to their school or community, how do they do that?
Well, it's very, very easy. All they need to do, they can either look up our website, which is janegoodall.org, and that tells them all about Roots and Shoots, or they can call our 800 number, which is 592-JANE.
Great. Dr. Goodall, let's talk about chimps for a little bit. Over your long career in research, you have taught us all things that we never anticipated. As you look back at the whole sum of it, what is the most important things that you've found, and what is the significance for us?
Well, I think the significant findings fall into two categories, really. One is things that pertain directly to certain aspects of chimp behavior, and the other is the sort of general philosophical way in which the study of chimps has taught us more about our own place in relation to nature. So if we take the first aspect first, the thing I think which is most significant for us is the what we've learned about chimpanzee infancy, the importance of early experience, the tremendous importance of the type of mothering that an infant receives, and how these events in early life really do shape adult behavior. And I think with what's happened in the developed world, with the change in family structure, with the increase of women in the workplace, with the increased breakup of families, we would tend to be nervous as to what effect this is having on our children. And you only have to look around in societies today to think, well, yeah, maybe that does have some part to play in the increased troubled years of youth.
I take it then that your research with chimps gives you some pause about what we're doing in our own society as it relates to the family and women and how we organize ourselves.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, as more and more women are working, some of them work because they want to for their careers, some of them because they have to for economic reasons. But specifically for the second group of women, then society must find some way of attending to the needs of the children. And there are so many daycare centers, as you well know, where the staffing is always changing. There's too many children per group. And they're not getting the kind of reassurance. They're not getting that close contact with one or two responsible adults, which I think is terribly important for them. And over and above that, they're spending hours watching violence on television. And they're becoming more and more wrapped up as they get older in the virtual reality of the computer world and less time to live in the real world. And so we're breaking their ties with the natural world, and I think that's a disaster.
Dr. Goodall, another issue that you've commented on frequently has to do with medical research and where we're going. Given the proximity between the chimp and the human, they obviously are targets for continued medical research. What kind of guidelines should we as a society apply to that kind of activity?
Well, there are, again, two issues here. And the first one is, what kind of conditions are we keeping these chimpanzees in? Our closest relatives, who are intensely social, who should have the freedom of the forest, the opportunity to decide each day what kind of day they're going to live, which group to travel with, where to go, what to feed on. And we're confining hundreds of them, hundreds and hundreds, in cages that are 5 foot by 5 foot. They're prison cells in which they're in solitary confinement, punished for crimes they never committed. And then there's the much harder ethical issue as to whether we should be using them at all. Do we have the right to use other creatures for purposes which may or may not be beneficial to mankind? And I think this is where that comes directly back to the other thing I think is so important that the chimps have taught us. They've helped to blur a line that was once perceived as so sharp between humans and the rest of the animal kingdom. You know, once they teach us that we're not the only creatures with personality, capable of rational thought, knowing emotions like happiness, sadness, fear, and mental as well as physical suffering, prepared to admit that, gives us a new respect, not only for chimps, I think, but for the other amazing animals with whom we share this planet.
And that raises such an interesting question, again, about the research. Should we be thinking about chimps as objects of scientific research differently than we might say mice because of their proximity to ourselves?
Well, that, again, is a speciesist argument, which obviously the degree of suffering that you inflict on animals, whether it be in research or intensive farming or fur farming, whatever it is, the degree of suffering you inflict presumably has an impact on how you view ethically the use of those animals at all. But if we just take medical research, is it not possible that had we never been so arrogant as to think that we could just use other animals for our own purposes, might our very brilliant brains have found other ways of doing this kind of research? I mean, today there are so many techniques like cell culture, tissue culture, computer simulation, which enable scientists to do the same research they used to do on animals without using any animals. And these are things which even 10 years ago there were animal experimenters who said, well, it's bad luck, but we're always going to have to use some animals for this kind of procedure. And that turns out not to be true.
Where are the big opportunities and challenges for research with chimps in their natural condition taking us in the near-term future?
In the natural condition?
Yes.
Well, I think it's tremendously important to have people out in the field, because once you get a group doing research in a patch of forest, that does focus attention on conservation issues, providing you work with the local people, which we always do. And it will help to conserve chimps across Africa, which is desperately important, because not only are you conserving amazing individuals, but each group of chimps has its own primitive culture, traditions passed from one family generation to the next through observation and imitation. And that's disappearing. As biological diversity is disappearing, so too is cultural diversity among the chimpanzees.
Are you hopeful with respect to the future of chimp populations in the wild?
I'm hopeful that we shall conserve some across their range. We shall lose others, but with education of young people, help from the developed world, yeah, we shall save some.
Thank you so much for being with us. My guest has been Dr. Jane Goodall, and I'm sure you have comments about what she has said, so share them with us. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Berlich. You can listen to The Environment Show anytime on your personal computer. Go to our website, www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. Once you've done that, write to us. The Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. We hear now what some of our listeners are saying. Here's Stephen Westcott.
We received a lot of comments regarding a recent discussion on solar energy and technology. Many listeners wanted more information about solar power, and one woman said we should follow up on how solar power can be used to electrify appliances, especially if the Y2K bug disrupts the power grid. A listener named Allison called our comment line to say,
I was delighted to hear you speaking of alternate renewable resources and speaking of solar energy. I was surprised, though, that the subject of hemp fuel was not brought up and not discussed. I would like very much for that to be something that's discussed and put on the table. And I know I'm not the only one. It's been actually in legislation. People have been trying to rally to be able to vote for such things, and I think it's a really valuable resource that needs to be investigated and needs to be looked at.
Wade listened to a Talking Green conversation and emailed us to say, quote, "In that show you were discussing environmental reporting with a CNN correspondent and the head of some university department devoted to environmental reporting. The reporter made a point of how he would make sure that research funded by industry would be pointed out as a potential conflict of interest. Would that reporter be so diligent about reporting the funding source of environmental research if it came from a so-called pro-environmental group? The problem with science reporting is that self-appointed environmental groups are assumed to be unbiased, while industrial groups are assumed to be biased. Bias is created when a group stakes out a position and is unable or unwilling to accept independent data that contradicts their established position. By that definition, many of the environmental groups would have a potential for bias in their research," end quote. A listener by the name of Jim called to express thoughts about another environmental issue.
My concern on the environment, or statement I'd like to make, is that one of the things overlooked is actually poverty being one of the causes of the environment, in the sense that, like in the Brazilian rainforest, that people will burn a great deal of the forest, or in Indonesia, to make space for themselves that wasn't there. And the poor use of fuel to keep warm, such as what's happening in Siberia, the use of coal. So I'd just like to bring that up.
Lastly, a listener contacted us through the questionnaire on our website to recommend that we do a series on green consumerism and how this can be fostered. He says, quote, "Why don't the giant environmental organizations and associations and clubs band together at the beginning of the new millennium and pool resources to initiate their own ad campaign? In other words, engage people, whet their appetite, and make them want to buy green," end quote. We appreciate all comments, questions, and suggestions. You can reach our comment line by dialing 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
Hello, operator, I want you to be mine. Please deposit all your love and put me on the line. I'm listed under lonely, lost and seen.
If you think it's PCBs that cause the feet of boobies to turn blue, you weren't paying attention. Also, you should hear Jane Goodall again. Call 1-800-323-9262 and order a copy of the show. It's program number 485. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, and Ray Graff is audio engineer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Be good to the Earth, and join us next week for the Environment Show.